You are tuned to CICK News on 93.9 FM in Smithers. CICK News is your news source for regional and provincial news Tuesdays and Thursdays at 8 a.m., 2 p.m., and 4 p.m. It's hosted by Dan Messick and myself, Pamela Hassan. Find and follow CICK News online at smithersradio.com and frequencynews.ca or wherever you get your podcasts. CICK News is funded by the Community Radio Fund of Canada and the Government of Canada.
Today on CICK News. On September 15th, Premier David Eby announced his government will build special facilities for those detained under the Mental Health Act, often referred to as involuntary care. As public safety concerns continue to grow amid the worst mental health and overdose crisis recorded in the province history, the NDP are looking to reassure voters that their communities are safe. However, not everyone is convinced this approach will work. Today, Pam speaks with Michael Crawford, the president of the British Columbia Association of Social Workers. Stay with us.
I'm Michael Crawford. I'm the president of the British Columbia Association of Social Workers.
Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me, Mr. Crawford. On Sunday, September 15th, Premier David Eby announced that the province will build secure regional facilities to house those detained under the Mental Health Act. And this is part of a public safety pitch. What was your response to this announcement? And if you could you kind of help our listeners understand what this all means?
When the Premier made that announcement last weekend, we were taken aback somewhat, although not completely surprised. It's probably more the timing of the announcement than what the announcement actually was that caught us a little off guard. Involuntary care discussions have been going on within the provincial government for some time. It's an issue that the Premier has raised publicly as much as a year ago. And involuntary care is an issue that comes up in the legislature from time to time. But really, until now, it's been more focused on legislation like the Secure Care Act that sought to be able to detain and coercively treat young people who were engaged in use of illicit drugs. So BC is no stranger to involuntary care. The kind of program that the Premier's talking about introducing is really just under the Mental Health Act. The Mental Health Act provides for the detention of individuals who appear to have a mental health issue and are a risk to themselves or others. And, you know, the province probably detains and coercively treats 20,000-25,000 individuals every year. So involuntary care is not a new issue for British Columbia in that way either. There may need to be some changes to the Mental Health Act, to that legislation. It is quite antiquated and badly in need of updating, but there may be some legislative changes to that act that would be required to accomplish the goals of the program that the involuntary care program that Mr. Eby wants to introduce.
Yeah, and touching on the timing of it, and that the timing sort of felt curious and maybe rushed. Can you kind of explain why that was BC Association of Social Workers' response?
Well, I mean, we were a bit surprised at the timing because the Ministry of Health is actually quite good at consulting and consulting quite broadly. So we were expecting that perhaps even in the new year, if this government continues after the election, that there would be a call for proposals or presentations or consultations with respect to this proposed involuntary care program. So that was really what we were looking for on the horizon, and we weren't really expecting sort of that the program would be announced and by the looks of it, put together quite quickly and rolled out, very soon. And you can see sort of the rush that the government's going to here, because the first two places that they name as secure facilities are both correctional institutes. Which is really problematic because, if you're engaged in using illicit drugs and you meet whatever criteria the government sets for including you in this involuntary care program, hearing that you're going to be detained by the state in a correctional facility for your own good, with little or no understanding of what the sort of exit criteria might be. In other words, what you need to do or what you need to say or perform or behave in order to be released, you might want to keep your drug use more hidden. And we know that when drug use is hidden, we see spikes in overdose deaths because people are not using publicly and they're not, they're not noticed. They're not, there no attempt can be made to resuscitate them if they're not not detected. And of course, detection goes up when the use is public rather than private. So yeah, we're not sure of the timing. We're surprised. We would have preferred that the government consult and consult broadly, because when you're introducing a program of involuntary care, you're really infringing upon people's human rights and rights to be free, the rights to have agency or autonomy. And these are very serious actions taken by the state, and it needs to be done in a way that protects people's dignity, respect, and their human rights. So yeah, a little surprised that we got that announcement rather than a invitation for consultation.
Yeah, absolutely. And you touched on you touched on something that I really wanted to have a lot of clarification from, which is what happens when people are forced to conceal drug use. And so you had mentioned that when it's forced in behind closed doors, that there is less, I guess, interference by the public if someone is experiencing an overdose. And before we were recording, you told me about some statistics from the BC Coroner's Office, death review panels about overdose deaths. Can you explain a little bit about what you said before we were recording today?
Right. A bit of a preamble first, though. This government stepped back from the 3-year commitment they made on decriminalization. The courts wouldn't allow them to do that, so the BC government went to the federal government to get them to change the conditions of their exemption. And so that was effectively recriminalizing drug use, and the attempt on the part of the government was to prevent public use of drugs. That's just a very, very dangerous thing to do, because you're driving people into the back alleys, and where they can't be detected. If they've overdosed, they can't be saved through the application of Narcan or naloxone. So, and this involuntary care program, we think will serve the same ends, that people will be using drugs less in public spaces, which I'm sure the public would appreciate. But unfortunately, the result of that is more overdose deaths. So something that most people, I think, don't really recognize is that, and we wonder if the provincial government does, is that according to the BC coroner, through their death review panels, they look at overdose deaths as a result of the unregulated toxic drug supply. And they typically find that about 80 or 81% of people who are dying from overdoses do so in residences. So some of those residences are shelters, hotels, other types of places like that. But half of all of the overdoses are occurring in private residences. So it just leads you to, I mean, what are we doing for those individuals? And it leads one to suspect that this involuntary care is the province's attempt to clean up the streets and to make public drug use less, or at least drug use less noticeable in the public sphere. So, yeah, that's, I mean, it's just very, very unfortunate that the government is really not moving ahead fast enough with the development of treatment and support programs and withdrawal management programs, not putting those inhalation injection sites, drug checking sites in play. And they've really stalled out on the prescribed alternative program, which people know mostly as Safer Supply. There's about 115,000 people in British Columbia, according to the public health officer, that have a diagnosis of opioid use disorder. And there's just slightly north of 4,000 people who are in that Safer Supply program. So Safer Supply or prescribed alternatives is really just that program. You get referred to it by a physician, you qualify by having a diagnosis of opioid use disorder. And then you have prescription that you fill at certain drugstores, and you pick up methadone or some other approved drug, and you know that that drug is not toxic. You know that you can take that drug. And that's a program that really just keeps people alive. And we know that works. It's a very effective program. And the government seems to have stalled out in with relation to expanding that program. So we're providing that program, the Safer Supply program, to less than 4% of all opioid use disordered individuals in the province. And we just keep saying to the government, you need to do more.
And what would it look like, Mr. Crawford, to attempt to strengthen the voluntary system of care, especially for younger adults and again, people who use substances? What do you think that the voluntary system of care looks like?
I think, in a word, inadequate and insufficient to supply. It's one of the questions the government of the day, and other, and political parties, provincially and federally, need to answer, is you want to bring in these involuntary care programs, and we got it. You think that that's a compassionate thing to do, and whose heart isn't affected when we see individuals on the street who are struggling, individuals in their homes who are struggling, and struggling to make good decisions for themselves with respect to their health care. So we know that more needs to be done. What is the answer from the government when there's people who are wanting treatment? They're volunteering for treatment. They call their withdrawal management or detox program, and I want to come in and detoxify my body, get me ready for treatment, and they're told, sorry, detox is booked up for several weeks or even longer. And so when someone's ready, they're ready. They need that service, very quickly, if not immediately, because the motivation can sometimes wane. And even people that do go through withdrawal management programs, there's often a long wait to get into treatment programs. Sometimes there's an exorbitant cost to going to those programs, and our follow-up programs are really insufficient. So, and that's true both for adults and for youth in this province. Governments tend to approach problems, in my experience, with half measures. And as a volunteer firefighter at one point taking training, the instructor basically said to us, if you have a fire in front of you and you have a fire extinguisher, use the whole fire extinguisher. Because if you haven't put it out with the first half and it flares back up, you're not going to put it out with the second half. I always think of that when I think about government's response to problems. And our response to the public health emergency declared in 2016 around the toxic drug supply has been a half measure. We're doing way more, and thankfully so. Since 2016, in response for that to that problem, but still our response is woefully inadequate.
We spoke today about safeguards that you believe should be in place in the Mental Health Act. I do believe that you've mentioned a few, but if you could kind of just almost list what you think would be the top priorities for safeguards in the Mental Health Act when we're talking about involving involuntary care.
Yeah, there's lots of self safeguards in the existing Mental Health Act. You know, you can be detained by one medical officer or physician. To be detained longer, you need two. And there's increasing periods of, you know, 1 day, 3 days, 7, 30 days. I'm not sure. I can't remember what the length of time is. But, you know, at each expiry date of your certificate, it needs to be renewed through an examination, and physicians need to make declarations with respect to, you know, your mental condition and the risk that you present to yourself and others in order to continue that certification. Mental health patients are to be if they're held involuntarily under a certificate, they're to be notified in certain ways and so forth. Unfortunately, what happens in our mental health system is that people aren't given that notification properly. They miss deadlines. There's a complicated application process to get your case before the Mental Health Review Board, which is essentially volunteers that the government appoints to sit on that board. There's people with lots of experience, physicians, social workers, lawyers, etc., that sit on those boards. But it takes time to get in front of them. And sometimes the decision that they make is rather disappointing for mental health patients who are seeking increased freedoms. And we also have within the Mental Health Act sort of community care or community treatment, where people, once they're discharged from a mental health facility, can be compelled to continue with treatment, whether that's medication or otherwise. And failure to maintain your treatment, you can be reincarcerated in a psychiatric facility. So there are those kind of safeguards, but you know, we don't really know what the inclusion criteria will be in this. I mean, we have to sort of, if we're just going to use the Mental Health Act, we're going to very quickly overwhelm the health system, because there's a lot of individuals on the street and also that are housed who might qualify under the Mental Health Act. So will there be further criteria established about who will be who will be included? And again, we're quite concerned that one of the real safeguards here is, when will we know that these individuals are ready for release from involuntary care? So, yeah, it's problematic from one end to the other. We're concerned about those human rights that people have, but we're also concerned about, you know, the clinical situation where, you know, you're firstly, where will the province find staffing? Where will they find the additional psychiatrists, social workers, psychologists, nurses, mental health therapists, etc.? Where will they find them? Because the public system is continually scrambling to recruit and retain these individuals within the health system. There's just shortages everywhere. So we're not sure where they're going to get them. Where are they going to build these facilities? Starting in a correctional facility is a very poor start to a program that's supposed to be, that we hope will be therapeutic rather than just punitive. And those individuals that we do recruit to work in these systems, will they be qualified? And how successful will they be delivering sort of coercive or mandated treatment? People who don't want treatment often don't benefit from treatment. If you have a bacterial infection and a physician or a nurse in injects you with penicillin or antibiotic, you know, try as you might, you're probably going to have that bacterial infection cured. And but that's not the way that's addictions and mental health aren't as straightforward as that.
Yeah.
And so we need people that are motivated. These program, treatment can simply take months or sometimes years. And there's often relapse. And the current system doesn't treat relapse very well. If you some programs, if you use drugs while you're involved in the program, you're immediately ejected. If you leave treatment early, it's difficult to get back in. If you relapse, you're seen as less likely to benefit from treatment, and so you're not accepted back into some treatment programs. So it's just very, very problematic. And once you've gone through detox, you've gone through treatment, you've been clean for some time, relapse is just part of that journey to finally getting away from drugs. And it's such a common experience. And so many people die when they relapse because their bodies, they haven't been using drugs for some period of time. They've been through detox, they've been through treatment, they've been clean for some time. And their body just doesn't have the tolerance to those drugs anymore. And they take the same amount they were taking before and they overdose. And that's just a horrible shame.
Yeah.
Weren't the health system isn't able to manage that. Somebody trying to do the right thing, they slip, they relapse again, which is so common, and they pay really the ultimate price for doing that.
Yeah, and what I'm really hearing is just again that knowledge and the kind of careful consideration of something such as what you were just mentioning, relapse as a part of the process, not a failure of someone's attempt to try to get better or even just find a more manageable way to live with an addiction. And just that the rush job of this program being pushed through feels almost totalitarian, how it's just coming in and it's just trying to exist, and the people who are actually going to have to deal with these new programs and these new rules are having to play catch up yet again. BC Association of Social Workers made a public letter. You made this statement, but do you feel like you're able to express these concerns to the Premier's office? And if you can't, is there something that you what would you ask him if you could?
Well, we would repeat what we have said and said often to the minister and to other senior officials within the Ministry of Health, as well as within the Ministry of Mental Health and Addictions. And that's, stop the half measures. We need to move forward with a very serious plan to address this problem, and it needs to be multifaceted. Recently I had a conversation a couple of months ago, a conversation with a business man who was very concerned about people on the street and the effect that it was having on his business. People would be sleeping in his doorway. He would sometimes be broken into, and things would be stolen. People wandering into the store looking for washrooms and really causing havoc, and he just wanted them gone, and he had his fill. And that's not difficult to understand. It's in the very same way that we find needles in parks, and parents are concerned about taking their children there. These are very understandable concerns, and what are we going to do about that? If we bring in voluntary care in, we're just going to sweep individuals up from the street that are public, and individuals that we find in their residences that don't seem to be making good decisions for themselves either, sweep them up and warehouse them. That's an approach that was used in the 1950s in British Columbia, and it was proven to be a disaster, really. We were using Matsqui Institution as a secure facility, as the premier would say. But back to this businessman, I said, well, what people on the street, here's their reality. They're addicted to drugs. They don't have any money to pay for them. They commit crime to pay for those drugs. They go to the unregulated drug market, where they buy drugs, and it's really a crapshoot there. You may get additional hit of fentanyl or some other drug, that ends your life. And you can't get into treatment. There's no supportive housing. So how about this for a plan? The government says if you're addicted, you can come to us and we'll give you clean drugs. You can use them in a safe inhalation injection site, which can also be mobile. We can talk to you about getting into detox treatment and support programs, and we can build those programs and we can staff them with individuals who are using evidence-based approaches to their work. And you'll still see these individuals on the street. They'll be in outpatient programs. They'll be getting their drugs from the drugstore. You won't see them on your doorstep. You won't see them breaking into your place because they don't need to steal in order to buy drugs. And they'll be in supportive housing with wraparound services, including health and social services. So, at that point, really, the person I was talking to said, that's a good plan. That's compassionate. It's well reasoned. It's thought out. That's what we've been proposing to health and to mental health and addictions for some considerable period of time. And we're just going to continue to encourage them to move in that direction. And we're very concerned with the rise of more conservative approaches to this problem, which seem to be attacking these harm reduction approaches that I've been talking about today.
I just really want to thank you for your time and for just all the care that you've obviously put into this very complex issue. So I really want to thank you for taking the time to speak with me.
Pamela, thanks for the interest you've shown in this issue.
You've been listening to CICK News. If you have any hot tips or news stories you think we should cover, contact us at CICKnews@smithersradio.com or check us out on the web at smithersradio.com. CICK News has been made possible by the Government of Canada and the Community Radio Fund of Canada, the only organization mandated to financially supporting campus and community radio stations across Canada. You can also catch our fresh shows each week at theskeena.com or subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google, or wherever you find your podcasts. Thanks to my colleague Pam Hassan and all of our roving journalists, I'm Daniel Messick. Thanks for listening.